Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, January 9th, 2014, and we're looking at the same headlines we've been looking at for quite some time now. It's all about NSA spying, Obamacare, and monetary policy. What else is new? It's kind of a light news week, so we're going to be able to spend a little bit more time talking about stuff that we like to talk about, and let's just facing up to the various headlines that we're trying
girls.
To wade through.
We're going
to
talk about girls.
Oh, you're talking about girls? Bill, I don't know how to tell you this, but we're both married men. That's not probably a good idea to do on a public airway.
You have to remind me.
Hey, yeah. You got a great wife. Robin's wonderful, you know?
She is. We are going on 34 years now.
34 years. That's fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, at the top of our headline list, there's a article that came out at thefiscaltimes.com called Why Too Big to Fail is a Bigger Problem Than Ever. And since it wasn't such a light news week, I figured this might be a good one to start off with because it's something we've talked about in the past here on the program. Both you and I, Bill, have talked about it, and I talked about it with a previous co-host in years gone by. The fact that too big to fail is, first of all, it's a misleading term. Second of all, it wasn't solved. It was actually accentuated. And third of all, it hasn't really gone away.
Yeah, you're right.
But I found the article to be interesting for a couple of reasons. One was that they brought up the topic, and two was that they very neatly danced around the source of the issue. They talked about how the banks that are too big to fail have gotten so much bigger. They talked about how the article talks about, for instance, how J.P. Morgan Chase has agreed to pay somewhere around $22 to $25 billion in fines and penalties for various illegal activities, from hiding its suspicions about Ponzi schemer Bernie Madoff to misleading investors about the notorious London Whale and a bunch of other stuff, too. And that the amount that they're paying in fines exceeds the assets of about most of the rest of the banking industry itself, except for the very largest banks. And so that becomes part of the argument that the banks that are too big to fail have indeed become even bigger and more of a problem than ever before. But about, let's see, 5 paragraphs in, the fifth paragraph says something that starts to be a little bit misleading. Let me read it to you, Bill, and you tell me what you think.
Yeah.
They say, a hearing held Wednesday by the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Development addressed one of the reasons why the banks are doing so well even as they face continued legal actions. They enjoy a massive subsidy rooted in the market's belief that should they ever get in trouble, the government will bail them out. That enables those banks to borrow more cheaply than their small competitors and lead shareholders to believe that they are protected from downside risk should the bank get in trouble. And that's true. But notice the one thing that they left out of the paragraph. They failed to mention what the source of the subsidy is. They said, yes, they're being subsidized, but where's it coming from?
Well, what the article asserts is that the subsidy is the belief that the government will bail out the banks.
Right.
Now, what that reminded me of instantaneously.
They say that the massive subsidy is rooted in the market's belief.
Right. What it reminded me of immediately was the story from maybe 6 years ago, just before the big financial ruckus went on.
Yeah.
And that was the belief in the market, which happened to be true, that Fannie and Freddie could not collapse and could not fail because the government wouldn't allow them to do that and they would get bailed out. There was nothing in the Fannie and Freddie, provisions of law or anything like that that said the government had to bail them out. They were called the private institutions that were processing these mortgages. Of course, everybody knew that there was no way that the Treasury Department was going to let them go into bankruptcy. Now, in effect, they already have. It's called receivership rather than bankruptcy. But because of the fact that the president appointed a majority of the board of directors for both of those organizations, they were called a public-private consortium. And on that premise alone, everybody said, don't worry, if Fannie and Freddie go belly up, government will bail them out. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. TARP was a bailout for Fannie and Freddie, basically. And as you're, I'm sure, aching to point out, for the past 4 years, the whole quantitative easing, or at least half of it, by the Fed, has been bailing out Fannie and Freddie. And they've been spending $40 billion a month for the past 4 years. They actually spent spent twice as much buying equity in these two corporations as the TARP funds did initially. It was $700 billion back in 2008 that was supposed to eliminate all of the troubled assets that were being held by Fannie and Freddie and the various banks. And so that was the big bailout that actually prompted the formation of the Tea Party. That was the first big issue. And so it's been going on for the past 4 years. And the amount of money, literally, in the neighborhood of $1.5, maybe $2 trillion, has gone into buying bad assets at Fannie and Freddie.
Right.
Now,
and that's the other problem I have with the article, because the article states that it's roughly $1 trillion that was subsidized into the banking system. But as you pointed out, the banking system through the Fed actually drew far more than a $1 trillion. And that trillion is basically the $700 TARP plus the following, plus the various bailouts that followed afterward before QE came along. So essentially, this article is trying to convince everybody that it was just the government that bailed out the banks and that the Fed really was not a player at all. And that's the part that gets me about it. Because this strikes me as the media trying to return us to the old line that the Fed is simply there to protect us from catastrophic events, and that beyond that they're a benign player, and that bugs me. Really bugs me.
Yeah. Well, you know, the standard line is, well, you know, the banks aren't really, you know, insured by the government. There's just the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and that just protects consumers and pays off, you know, consumer deposits when a bank goes belly up. And, of course, they've been doing that off and on now and then for decades. The total assets in the FDIC is equal to 0.001% of the total deposits.
Yeah, which is insane. Now, the other thing that also caught my attention, and you elucidated on it very nicely when you talked about how the government didn't let Fannie and Freddie fail. More precisely, they didn't let Fannie and Freddie fail where the banks were concerned. They were very happy to let it fail where the investors were concerned. That was okay.
And the consumers.
Yeah, perfectly okay. The only thing that was not acceptable was for Fannie and Freddie to fail where the banks were concerned.
Yeah.
And that really sticks in my craw in two ways. First of all, they don't really elucidate on that in the article. They don't make it clear that only the haves were bailed out.
Yeah. Well, it's the other thing that struck me is in the commentary is pointing out that 99.1% of the banks have less than $20 billion in assets.
Yeah.
That means it's a little bit less than the top 1% of the bank that holds all the profits and assets and resources and so on. And those are the people that the Treasury Department talks to every day. Those are the people that run the Treasury Department.
Yeah, right, exactly. They may not do it directly, but they don't need to. Their own people are the ones who get nominated to the various posts, and virtually the entire regulatory structure is run by ex-employees of the big banks.
Yeah, there were some very good books that have been written on the big collapse and the big bailouts and all that kind of stuff, and it's fascinating. The Treasury Secretary at the time, Paulson, called up like the 12 biggest banks, I think it was, and said, you're coming to D.C., and didn't tell them why, and sat them down and said, we're going to give you $700 billion, and we can't tell anybody who is taking it or not taking it, so you're all going to accept the money we're offering you.
Whether you want it or not.
Whether you want it or not, whether you need it or not, because we can't disclose which banks are really in big trouble.
Yep.
And so this story over the past 4 years has been, well, you know, all the TARP funds were just loans, and they were all paid off, and yep. it didn't cost the American taxpayers anything. It wasn't really a bailout until you read the backstories of how they paid off those debts and who is now holding the assets of those banks. Duh,
that's
the
right.
Fed.
There you go.
Yep.
That's it. That's it in a nutshell. In fact, I think I mentioned this to you before. I know I've mentioned it on the program before, but the movie Too Big to Fail has a wonderful ending because I can't think of the gentleman's name who played Ben Bernanke is. He's an actor I've seen before, and I just can't remember his name. But he has one of the last lines in the movie. They've gotten the top, I guess it's the top seven banks or whatever it was, to accept the TARP bailout, even the ones that didn't want it. And they basically have succeeded in putting it over on the public and on the system. And Bernanke turns to the other two, to Krugman, or not Krugman, to one you just mentioned. I can't remember what his name is.
Paulson.
Paulson, yes.
Get
to Paulson and to his counterpart over at Treasury, over at the New York Fed, who later became Treasury. I can't remember what his name was either. But he turns
they're all Goldman Sachs people.
Yeah, they're all Goldman Sachs. Doesn't matter. They're all interchangeable. But he turns to me and he says, this is going to work because now we've put liquidity back into the system and the banks are going to loan this money out and that's going to get the economy going. And then he pauses and he says, they are going to lend it out, aren't they?
And of course, the fact of the matter is they didn't loan it out. What they did, and we've discussed this at some length over the course of the past several weeks, what they did was they loaned the money to the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones stock corporations because they too are too big to fail and they deserve the big boost, and so there's a stock market bubble. Now with the tapering coming, that bubble seems to be kind of shrinking a little bit, or who knows, maybe it's going to pop this year.
Yeah, isn't that the definition of a shrinking bubble?
Well, they use these words like tapering, you know, like it's, you know, we're just, you know, taking in the inseam a little bit, you know, where in fact, it, even cutting it by a small amount, to 10%, the stock market drops by a couple hundred points.
That's funny how leveraging works.
So it's hard to deflate a bubble without exploding it. But we'll see what happens, you know, maybe they can pull it off.
You really think so?
Well,
seriously, I don't see how you deflate a bubble without popping it. I don't see that.
Well, because you just hide the bubble, that's all. So that people don't recognize that the stock market is up because the Fed is pumping, you know, $40 billion into the economy and the housing sector and buying out $40 billion worth of treasuries.
And yeah, I'll buy that because essentially the way they cover it up is by creating a whole bunch of more bubbles so that you always have I'm forever blowing bubbles.
And that you just move the bubble around.
Bubble economy.
I mean, that's the other half of the quantitative easing is the Treasury has been buying up, not Treasury, the Fed has been buying up U.S. Treasury bills. And the incongruity of a government, quasi-government agency buying up the debt of the federal government in order to keep the interest rates low on the bonds that are being sold. And it's as though you're making the what were we at, $17 trillion in debt or something like that, disappear by, you know, being absorbed into the Fed a little bit at a time. And it's spooky when you think about what they're doing and what the possible consequences could be. And the only saving grace they have is that every other damn country in the world is doing exactly the same thing, if not worse.
It does raise an interesting mental exercise, though, and that is, I don't think this could ever play out far enough. I think it would collapse long before. But what if it gets to the point where the Fed owns everything?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, that's where it heads, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. In terms of, you know, economic power, Congress is totally neutered. The Fed basically owns the economy.
Which is a really warm and fuzzy thought to have.
you recall my little comment a few weeks back? I said, this is what fascism looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
Where the government owns everything and they just have the pretense of private enterprise and everything is run out of the central offices by the big bankers.
And kind of along the same line, you dug up a couple of interesting monetary-based quotes. Why don't you share some of that information?
Well, people may have noticed that this is the 50th anniversary of LBJ's war against poverty. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are various articles pointing out that, well, poverty is exactly where it was, 50 years ago when we started the war against poverty. But in LBJ's State of the Union speech, there was a fascinating quote. And I'll just read the quotation of what LBJ said to Congress. We seek not just freedom, but opportunity. We seek not just legal equity, but human ability. Not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result. Now, this is pure, unmitigated Marxism. The idea that freedom is more control by government, that the solutions to everyone's problems are with government, and that everyone being equal, not just legal, equal rights under the law or anything like that, but being equal in ability is the proper goal of government. Not just equality as a right. In other words, there's no fundamental human right to do what you please and to succeed and accomplish the things you want, but that everything has to be equal, both in terms of ability, but also as a result. And so that was the fundamental goal that LBJ pursued, which unfortunately had been followed and implemented by a host of Republicans and Democrats since then.
And with absolutely dismal results. I mean, we aren't anywhere near close to the goal. Even if you consider the goal to be a good goal, we aren't anywhere near the goal. It's not even close.
Well, what the goal is to pauper the middle class by sustaining the poor class so that the rich class can take care of all the benefits. And since they're controlled by government, it's all for the greater good.
Well, that's what it has turned into, but that's certainly not the way it was originally thought, at least by the people who heard the speech. Now, I can't say what was in LBJ's mind, but for the people who supported it, for the people who support the idea of equality, they certainly never thought in terms of the top 1% controlling 99% of everything and that being equality.
Well, no, but like I pointed out, the irony was that Johnson this quote was actually from a speech to black college students. And the irony was, here was a highly privileged white president talking to a class of black students, telling them that his objective was absolute equality of human ability and equal results for all.
Yeah.
In other words, our goal in the United States is for the entire country to become a colony of ants, everyone exactly identical, doing exactly the same thing under the sole direction of the government. I mean, we talked about 1984. I mean, that is 1984.
Actually, it's more like 1921 in Henry Ford's factory.
Well,
it is.
The other quote was from Henry Ford. It was talking about the banking system and the government's objectives. His quote was, it is well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking system and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning.
The only thing wrong with that quote is I don't think he actually said it.
Oh, really?
I've actually researched that one, and I can't find a source for it. I don't think the source exists. I think that's one of those made-up quotes.
Well,
but it's a great quote.
Could be. Well, if I recall correctly, I didn't research it to find the location, but it was somebody who had a private conversation with Henry Ford and paraphrased what he had told them.
It'll be nice if you can find who that is, because that would be at least a source. I've never found a source for it. All I found is allegations that he said it.
Yeah, I'll check around and see what I can find.
Yeah, if you could, that'd be great. I'd love that. But it's a great quote because first of all, it turns out to be somewhat true. But at the same, by the same token, I would say that it's also not true. And let me tell you what I mean by that. The first part of the quote is the part I'm reacting to. It says, it is well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system. I think it's fair to say that the majority do not understand the banking and monetary system. However, I think it's also fair to say that a minority do. And that's the part that it took me a long time to really come to grips with. I really bought into the idea that the overwhelming majority didn't understand it. And when I wrote my book, The Money Suckers, which was basically a fictional novel based on the events of 2008, distributed it to my small number of readers and got some feedback from people, I was astonished, particularly among conservatives who I shared it with, because I did go to a couple Tea Party groups and made presentations and so forth, got some good feedback. And I was amazed at how many people in there really did understand the banking and monetary system, but they just didn't care enough about it. It just wasn't that important to them. Or it's outside their control, so we're just not going to pay any attention to it.
There's a whole genre of writing recently about the rational ignorance of the American voter.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that as long as in your own life you're surviving and achieving the things you want to achieve, or at least have some hope that that's going to happen, you don't have the time nor the interest in trying to figure out what the elite is doing with your money.
Right.
You just have to deal with the reality that's the way it is and make the best of it.
And that's why I think that the quote, as admirable as it is questionable, because the assumption is if people, or at least I'm going to say at least some of the people, understand the banking and monetary system, according to the quote, he believes it'd be revolution before the next morning. Well, clearly not. Here we have a whole bunch of people who feel that it's outside their control or that it doesn't really directly affect them or whatever else, and so there's no revolution the next morning.
Well, we don't talk about it often, and maybe we can put this off.
Well, we do,
but most
people don't.
No. Here's the thing.
We're abnormal here.
Well, yeah, but we don't talk about it a lot, and that is, what is the solution? How do you fix this? How do you instill into people solution to the problem? Once they recognize it, if they understand that the banking and monetary system is a huge ripoff and con game, what do you do to fix that? How do you elect people that are willing to say the banking and monetary system is a fraud, you're getting ripped off, the middle class and the poor are being destroyed and the rich are benefiting? How do you fix that? I mean, do you dissolve the Fed? Do you pay off the national debt and just shut down the government for a couple of years? How do you fix something like that? I mean, it's grown so monstrous over the course of many, many, many decades, for nearly 100 years now. How can you possibly fix anything like that? And if you can't fix it, then let's just get along with what we've got and do the best we can.
I think it can be fixed. I think what really is missing is not the solution how to fix it. I think what's missing is the will to fix it. And we can have a long discussion about why that will is lacking. But let's assume for the sake of discussion that there was national will to fix it. If that were the case, fixing it actually isn't all that difficult. I mean, we already have one piece of the puzzle has gained a large section of support among the population. That's Ron Paul's audit of the Fed bill, now carried on by his son Rand Paul in the Senate. And that in and of itself won't fix anything, but it's one of the first steps that you have to take. And ultimately, it does lead to the dissolution of the Fed. Now, secondly, in order to dissolve the Fed, you also have to dissolve the real reason, the real justification, I should say, for having a Fed in the first place, for having a central bank, not the reason that the bankers have in mind and that the Fed advocates have in the mind for being able to control the economy and all that kind of stuff, but the original one of being able to cover the need of what happens when there's a bank panic, when there's run on a bank.
the Fed was originally created supposedly to address that need. And addressing that need is actually simple enough. You make it illegal for banks to commit fraud. Now, I'll grant you that it's actually a rather radical proposal. But when you state it properly, which is that the banks are committing fraud by basically taking depositor money and lending it out while promising to pay it back to the depositors, that is, it may not be legally fraud right now, but morally and philosophically, it certainly qualifies as fraud. So you make it illegal to do that. You say, well, banks, if you want to lend out money, you can't just take depositors' money, lend it out, and promise to give it back to the depositors. You got to either get them to sign on to the loan and they share the proceeds, or you got to give it back to them without lending it out. You can't do both.
Yeah, well, granted, what I'm talking about is the psychology. I mean, even if everybody recognized that this was a huge Ponzi scheme and it's a huge con job and it's total fraud all the way forward and backward, you don't just turn it off with the switch.
No, it would require a plan. There's no doubt. But the way you phrased it, it made it sound like you can't conceive of a plan, that no one could conceive of a plan. And actually, it's pretty easy to conceive of a plan. That's why I say what's lacking isn't the plan, it's the will.
But people have to be persuaded that not only is this a problem, but there is a way to fix it. And I think
those are two very important and very different things. I agree. You have to have both those factors. And that's why I say you have to have the one before the other. You have to have the national will. And the only way to have the national will is if people recognize it as a problem. So I agree with that.
Well, but I think it's a little bit more than that. I think people are, even if they recognize the whole system is screwed up, they're not going to press for changes until they're persuaded that the changes are actually going to solve the problem. For example, the Ron Paul crowd says, well, you just eliminate the Fed. Well, eliminating the Fed just puts the power of inflating currency and controlling the economy back into the hands of Congress. Now, quite frankly, I can't think of anything worse than eliminating the Fed at this point and giving Congress the power to do what the Fed does.
I agree.
Because that's the furthest thing from a solution that there could possibly be. So abolishing the Fed accomplishes really nothing.
And what you're talking about is the monetary system side. I was talking about the banking system side. But you're right. The monetary system side also has to be addressed. And that side can be addressed. Again, Ron Paul had the answer on that one. It was his free currency or something like that. Basically, the idea that you could create any currency you want and use it even based on gold or silver, and basically eliminate all the blocks that the federal government has put in the path of using gold or silver as money, so that by having the option for competing money supplies and having those money supplies, at least some of them perhaps, be precious metal based, then it becomes possible to have a limited money supply, and that essentially takes away the power, the monopoly power that the government or the Fed or some combination thereof have to continue to inflate the money supply.
Yeah, we talked to G. Edward Griffin just a few weeks back, and he was basically saying that competitive currencies was the solution. And may very well be, and maybe that's something we can spend some time on in the coming
weeks. Well, it's not just competitive currencies. Competitive currencies, yes, I agree, but it also has to be competitive currencies where it becomes legal to use gold and silver. And that's the part that's missing. Right now, we could set up competitive fiat currencies, but we're not allowed through, because of the regulatory structure in place, to set up competitive currencies that are based in gold and silver. And that's the problem.
Right.
Well, listen, we're halfway through the show. Let's take a break. And then after the break, maybe we can talk about some of the other articles we had. Because there's quite a bit on the list here now that we got half the show over. But we'll start talking about Obamacare and NSA spying and all that good stuff when we get back. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. And we'll be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And let's start talking about Obamacare, because we love to talk about Obamacare whenever we get a chance. And it turns out that the White House was doing a lot of crowing the last few days, saying that over 2 million people have now enrolled for Obamacare, and that this proves that the program really is taking off. So all Obamacare supporters should be celebrating and jumping up and down, shouldn't they, Bill?
Well, you know, let me give you just a little perspective on the whole situation. There are all kinds of goof-ups and mix-ups, and there are going to be little technical problems and things like that. But that isn't really the problem with Obamacare. Obamacare is not a problem of the implementation. Obamacare is a problem of philosophy. It's a problem of ideology. The whole system is based on the belief that the government can solve these problems better than individuals in the market can do. And that is going to, you know, make itself obvious once all the technical glitches are out of the way. When Obamacare is successful, what you're going to see is a total destruction of the entire U.S. health system. Doctors are going to stop practicing, hospitals are going to stop treating, insurance companies are going to start withdrawing from the market, and it's probably going to take a year or two to become evident that the whole thing is collapsing just under its own weight of the philosophical idea that government can control all of this and actually has the intelligence and the ability to run the American medical health system.
At which point President Obama probably steps in and starts ordering people back to work.
Well, that was Richard Nixon's response when the gold crisis hit.
That's right.
Freeze all wages and prices and you know, mandate that hospitals do this and do that and mandate that doctors do this and do that, and you just, you know, stop retirements and you require them to do the business for the benefit of the people. After all, that's the whole purpose.
That's right, and government knows best.
However, as to the current fuss and the brouhaha, the government is releasing no information. People are being led to believe that 2 million people have signed up on the Obamacare insurance exchanges prior to the deadline, which was January 1st. However, the government is not saying that there are 2 million people who have actually bought insurance. It is saying that they have merely selected a plan which is in process with the insurance companies and may or may not be implemented by a person actually paying a premium. And there are, the number you almost never hear is that even if all those 2 million people were people that actually got insurance, not enrolled on a website, but actually paid for insurance and got it, in order for Obamacare to work financially, and this was something that was discussed at great length while the debate was going on, in order for them to achieve what they want to achieve, they needed to have, by the end of this year, 3.5 million people, new people, enrolled in insurance policies, and 7 million people by March 31st, which is the date when the IRS starts imposing penalties and stuff like that. So even assuming 2 million came in, there are 4 to 5 million people who have lost their insurance. So at best, in comparison with where we were a year ago, the number of people who are insured has fallen by at least 3 million people. And there is no way that Obamacare as a system is going to be able to pay for itself. There are a variety of different taxes. There's tax subsidies and so on and so forth. None of that is going to cover the cost. And they aren't releasing any data that anyone can look at and say that this is actually financially viable.
Well, they have put it off for a year, though. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but those policies that were canceled, the administration, under no authority that I can find, anywhere, so other than the fact that Obama can do whatever he wants, the administration basically ordered a suspension of the rule that said that those health policies that weren't good enough to continue under Obamacare could continue for one more year. So
not quite.
No?
I mean, that's the impression he wanted to give. That's not quite what they did. Because the insurance companies are controlled by every state, every individual state, he asked the insurance commissioners of the states to allow the insurance companies to offer the not the bronze plan, but the catastrophic plan as a replacement for the canceled policies. Some of them said that they were willing to do that, but there's absolutely no statistics indicating that any insurance company has offered any plan to the people to have canceled.
I can get personal testimony on that because I have insurance for Anthem and they offered it to me.
They offer you a catastrophic or a bronze plan?
Catastrophic.
No, catastrophic. See, in the law, they cannot offer a catastrophic plan. They are in violation of the federal law and they are in violation of any state laws regarding the policies that can be provided. The catastrophic plan in the law specifically only for those who are 30 years old or less who have below 133% of the poverty scale. In other words,
I have to clarify my statement then because I said catastrophic because it wasn't the bronze plan, so I automatically said catastrophic. What they've done is they have allowed me, Anthem has said, we will allow you to continue with the plan you already had that we were going to cancel. We're going to let you continue it through the end of the year because the administration gave us the ability to do that. So that was literally what they told me.
That was very nice of them. There are some insurance companies that are doing that. But what it amounts to is a catastrophic plan, and according to the law as it's written, you can't have that plan. They can't offer you that plan.
And yet we also know that the president can basically rewrite the law anytime he wants to because that was another provision we found. So apparently both conditions can hold true at the same time.
well, you know, all this ruckus over the market website, what that covered initially for these past 3 months is just individual policies. Because the first thing that they did was say, hey, we can't put up the website for employer policies because it isn't done. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. We can't finish that program, and we probably can't get it done for another year.
Which, of course,
so
is not the real reason.
So they postponed all of the Obamacare application to employer-provided health insurance. Now, what's going to happen in October 1st of next year, it's just before the election, basically, and somebody said, how in the world did they set this schedule? Just before the election, the people who are in employer insurance programs are going to start getting letters from their employers or from their insurance company saying, oops, sorry, we cannot continue the policy that you currently have. And therefore, you must go and select from among these policies which your employer has approved, which comply with Obamacare. So you're going to have another, not 4 or 5 million, but 50 or 60 million people who suddenly discover that their employer health insurance doesn't exist anymore or is going to cease to exist a year from now. And I had to postpone that.
I'm going to experience something like that in the next 2 weeks. Not through an employer because I'm self-employed, but rather the fact that my wife and I are preparing to move from Virginia to Connecticut. And Virginia and Connecticut have two entirely different implementations of Obamacare.
Yeah.
So even though I've got this policy through Anthem that was basically a catastrophic policy, and I've had it all this time, just by moving to Connecticut, I'm going to lose it.
Yeah. Well, you know, there were people who were saying, well, you couldn't get the information about the various policies that were available in various places and, you know, what options there were from the website. And that's true.
Yeah.
But there was a hidden file on the website that you couldn't access, you know, through the normal navigation, which was actually a database of all the policies, who they were offered by, where they were applicable, and they are on a county-by-county basis throughout the United States. I mean, it's like 5,000 different counties, and each county has its own options in terms of what policies are being offered by the insurers in that state who are interested in offering their policies in that county. And one of the things that is not listed anywhere aside from in this database are the catastrophic policies, and that was the one that's supposed to be just for people under 30. And those catastrophic policies are about 90% the same price as the bronze plan and just have a higher deductible. But you can't find those prices anywhere except in this huge, humongous database, which I downloaded and subsequently deleted because I didn't want 3 gigabytes of information on my machine. So anyway, you won't know until, I think it's 2017, when all of the different provisions of Obamacare are actually in place and operational. That is, assuming Obama isn't still there to postpone them for another year or two. But every piece that's implemented, piece by piece, is going to create its own disaster. And those disasters are just multiplying over and over and over again in the health provider classifications. For example, one of the most popular Medicare plans is Medicare Advantage. That becomes illegal next year. There can be no such thing as Medicare Advantage. And there are like 70 or 80 million people on Medicare Advantage who are suddenly going to discover that it doesn't comply with Obamacare. And they're not going to support the insurance companies that are running it. So every little bit that gets implemented is another new disaster. It's a slow-motion train wreck is what it is.
It is. It's kind of fascinating in that sense.
Watching a 100-car train, just slowly falling off the rails and going into oblivion.
Or another way to describe it, it's like being on the highway, all the traffic goes to a slow crawl because everybody's rubbernecking to see the accident on the other side of the guardrail.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy. Don't believe a word that they say, and they're saying very few words when they say that there are 2 million people enrolled. According to a survey of the various insurance health plans, as many as 80% of the people they're counting haven't actually paid a premium. And they postponed the deadline for paying a premium to January 10th, which is tomorrow, folks. So if you haven't paid your premium by tomorrow, you've got no insurance. Mm. March 31st deadline is not the deadline for getting insurance. It's the deadline that you have to prove to the IRS that you have insurance in order to qualify for the subsidies.
Right.
So it's not that you can wait until March 31st to get your health insurance. You have to actually have it in effect as of January in order to get the full tax credits.
And the fact that most people don't have it and won't have it is where a lot of the ruckus starts to kick in.
Yeah, and then you find other provisions starting to kick in, like Obamacare has so-called death panels.
No, there are no death panels.
But Sarah Palin was poorly informed and didn't recognize that there is a provision in the Patient Protection Bill that sets up a government panel that is going to determine what is the appropriate treatment for every form of illness and what is the appropriate payment for that illness. And this is being done in cooperation with several other departments. They haven't even started to do that yet. And once they start doing that, they're going to be sending out notices to doctors saying, hey, if you think you have breast cancer, tough luck, you can't get the government won't pay for a test of, for breast cancer as an example. Only once every 2 years. And so they are going to change the requirements for treatment of various illnesses and so on. Without any public notice, they're just going to say, hey, Obamacare is not going to pay for these services because we don't think they're necessary. And that's going to apply to almost every kind of medical treatment that exists in the United States. So it'll be interesting as that starts to move in place after the employer thing goes into effect, but just prior to the next election, to see what a disaster there's going to be with doctors shrieking and complaining that they can't treat their patients the way that they think they need to be treated. because well,
actually, everything's going to be complaining. The doctors are going to be complaining. The patients are going to be complaining. The hospitals are going to be complaining. And the insurance companies are going to be complaining.
Yeah, well, the insurance companies aren't complaining. Because
well, they will, though. They're going to start complaining because they're not getting enough of the, quote, healthy, unquote, people signing up. So far, it looks like the people who are signing up are people who have pre-existing conditions. They're already high-risk people, all that kind of stuff. It isn't the people who are supposed to be providing the funding, basically, the young, who are signing up in droves.
Well, you didn't read page 2127, which says that the government will bail out any insurance company that isn't making a profit by selling Obamacare policies.
Well, that's probably true. The problem is, what are they going to bail it out with? And even the federal government is starting to become extended on the credit. At some point, the Fed starts creating enough money that even Paul Krugman notices.
Well, it's written as one of those vague promises that says this or that, border panel or whatever is going to review insurance company profits, and if they're making less than 15% profits, they will give them the profits. Even though they're not making any money on the Obamacare program, the insurance companies will still make a profit.
First question is, how much of a profit will it be?
15%.
15% of what, though?
Of the total business they're doing.
Does it say actually 15% of the total business?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's,
really?
There's two provisions of the code. One provision says that they have to spend 85% of their proceeds on benefits for the patient. Clause two is that if they are providing those benefits dictated by the law and they're not making that extra 15% for their overhead and salaries and so on, then the federal government will compensate them for that loss.
Okay. Well, that certainly sounds like it. Of course, I have a feeling the government's going to find some way of saying, well, it's actually not 15% of everything.
I am sure, when it comes down to dollars and cents and they start seeing that they've got to bail out a dozen different insurance companies because they're going broke on Obamacare, there's going to be much wailing and gnashing of teeth.
And there's also the possibility of kind of like what you hinted at a few weeks ago where you said ultimately the whole goal of this thing is to take the insurance companies out of the loop entirely. So this may be the first step.
Yeah, I mean, if you take Rahm Emanuel's alleged comment, if you need a crisis to really make change, you have to take advantage of every crisis. They're creating a crisis so that somewhere down the line they can say, ha-ha, we told you so. It had to be a single-payer plan. The government has to run everything. We can't do these market things anymore. They're not going to work. The market has obviously failed. The free market is a disaster. So we're just going to shut everything down, and we're going to run the whole show.
God help us when that happens. Okay, well, we've got, four or five, 6 minutes left. I don't think it's enough to cover the rest of Obamacare, let alone the other side, but let's get a little bit of it covered. You dug up an interesting piece about a Democratic lawmaker who claims that Obamacare enrollment is due to the Republicans, and that's why enrollment has been low. I thought that was an interesting claim.
Yeah, there's another interesting thing. If we're short on time, there was an article in the Washington Examiner about Walmart's program as compared with Obamacare programs.
Yeah, that was interesting, too.
Which I thought was intriguing. There was a study that was done by the independent insurance agents, health underwriters, blah, 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 blah. And they compared the policy that would be issued under Obamacare with the current policy that's being offered by Walmart to their employees. And Walmart has two different options. And all of them have premiums of either a half or a quarter of what the Obamacare plans have. Now, this is an employer program, remember, so it's still legal for them to continue this for another year. And the deductibles were on the average half. They said that unsubsidized Obamacare enrollees will face monthly premiums that are 5 to 10 times higher than Walmart premiums. at least until the end of this year, at which time Walmart is going to have to start complying with Obamacare. So you're going to have a lot of employees, like I just said, that are going to start losing all of their employer-provided coverage. But for the moment, your best bet is to get a job at Walmart, I suppose.
I think it's a fair word from death, but actually for some people that's a family-saving grace because the state of the economy for so many people is so bad. But, I mean, there are people who would pray for a full-time job at Walmart. So, I mean, we make fun of the fact that we wouldn't want to take a Walmart job, but, you know, in all seriousness, boy, some people have it really, really bad. I don't know how else to say that.
We were talking a little earlier about rational ignorance, and one of the little clips that I found amusing was a George Will column talking about political ignorance. And he was noting how little people know about what their government is doing.
Yeah.
In 2003, 70% were unaware of the enactment of the prescription drug entitlement. It was then the largest expansion since Medicare. According to the Zogby poll in 2006, 3 years after it was adopted, only 42% could name the three branches of the federal government. Will says voters cannot hold officials responsible if they don't know what the government is doing and what parts are doing it. 20% think the sun revolves around the earth.
That one really caught my attention. 20%. Wow.
Yeah, and therefore it's unsurprising that a majority are unable to locate major states such as New York on the map. 50% of the people could not identify the location of the state of New York. Hmm. So his point was...
What's scary is that 30% of them were from New York.
His point was all of these new information technologies, like Google and so on and so forth, are very useful and they're available, but people don't take the time to understand what the government is doing. And they don't understand the consequences of government's expansion and that ignorance of what government is doing, whether it's Obamacare or NSA or whatever it is having a major effect upon the voting population, because if they're uninformed and they don't know what's going on, those are the people who are most likely to vote, and they're most likely to vote for incumbents. But he was pointing out that there is so much the government is doing that there is to be uninformed about. But the only rational thing to do is to try to ignore it if you possibly can.
Well, all I can say in response to that is I've got to figure that the late Harry Brown, who was twice the Libertarian Party candidate for president, must be smiling somewhat sadly from his seat in heaven as he watches all this stuff, because he's the one who came up with the quote that actually has real health care insinuation in the metaphor that it uses. And the quote is that government breaks your leg, hands you a crutch, and then says, see, without us, you couldn't walk.
Exactly.
I mean, does that summarize Obamacare or what?
That's very true. Very true.
Listen, Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Hey.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. It's finally the table. I'm starting to turn. Talking about a